Let's Talk Money.
Good afternoon, Chattanooga. You're listening to Let's Talk Money with Jim Place and Kyle Bryant. 267-1023 is the number. Start our market day out with the Dow Jones sitting at 49,878, up 345 points. S&P sits at 6,906.
You could try that again in English.
Up about 63 points. If I could get through that without interruption, be nice. Jim, how are you?
I'm doing fine, as a matter of fact. Introduce our guest.
We've got today with us my friend, distinguished attorney Justin Furrow from Chambliss, Bonner & Stoffel. He is a lot of things, but one thing he also is our only prank caller to this show. I don't know if you know that.
Yes,
Jim.
I do know that.
I prefer unidentified anonymous caller.
Yeah, he called a... Some of his colleagues were on here, and he called with a very detailed tax question to see if they could answer it. And
what did you say your name was? What the cover?
I don't know exactly what you're talking about.
And a lot of people tell me, like, I'm going to call in and throw some question at you, but none of them ever actually do it.
All right, I have a question for you guys on the front.
Should we check on Max? Max, are you there before we get too carried away?
No, I'm still at the car dealership.
All right, good deal. Go ahead, Jim.
All right, here's my question. It has nothing related to legalese.
Thank God. He's probably, you know, anyway.
Did you guys, headline said this. I don't even know why I went here, but I thought it was
that's okay.
It says, why locking your Social Security number is the new credit freeze. Did you know you can lock your Social Security number? I had never heard of it.
I assumed it was part of the credit freeze deal, but I've never actually
It's really not. I'm not going to get into it in great detail here because we're going to talk about other stuff.
Yeah.
But when I'll come back to them. There is a way to literally lock down your Social Security number. The only thing is when you lock it down for your use too.
Okay. So is it for everything? Like right now I'm going through a passport renewal process. Would it lock it out where you couldn't renew your passport?
Like
you
got to go. It would lock it out for anything. Yeah.
Okay.
It's your Social
Seems
Security
like a
number.
Pain.
It was never designed to be a master key.
Yeah.
But it's become a master key for everything.
Yeah.
I mean, it's become a source of identification. It was never intended. It was a number that was never supposed to be released to anybody.
Yeah.
And it's a number now that, I mean,
virtually put it on
every form you guys
everywhere.
Fill out got it on there. And as they said, to truly protect your future, you need to transition from a passive defense to an active one. Locking your Social Security number is a strategic move that shuts down the most two common avenues for fraud, illegal employment and unauthorized access to government records.
Interesting.
And there is a way that you can go, and I'm not going to go in detail now, but there is a way that you can do that, but it's kind of cumbersome if you want to use it for something else.
Hmm.
You know, it's interesting you mentioned that. I have a colleague whose husband, his Social Security number is being used for employment down in Florida. The guy's apparently getting paying taxes.
Yes.
It messes up the tax deal every year, but it's a real thing.
Well, not only is it a real thing, but I mean, all of a sudden that number's being used and you're getting taxed on something.
Well, we see it all the time, or in the old firm, we saw it all the time with people would take your Social Security and file fraudulent tax returns. And so you can go get a PIN number to kind of protect against that.
But they talk about that in there too.
It's a huge pain to get that unraveled because you're dealing with the incompetency of the IRS who's like, what?
Well, and once you go that PIN route number, you can't go back.
That's right. And
they've got to furnish you with
a new
PIN number every year.
Which is fine. I mean, it's an extra step. It's a lot easier to do that than try to unravel
anybody it. That's been through fraud and that nature, that's been the recipient of a fraudulent activity of that nature, it is a pain.
It is.
Yep. Yep. I mean, you're literally guilty until you prove yourself innocent.
Right. Oh, well. All right. Moving on, I appreciate the tidbit. Justin, tell us what you do, how you got to Chambliss, what you do, just a little background on who you are, your specialty.
So my specialty is labor and employment law, which means I represent companies with employment issues, and that touches, frankly, the life cycle of the employment relationship from applications, from advertisement, job postings, all the way through termination, and if
I mean, that would be sexual harassment. It'd be everything within the field.
Anything employment.
Everything
from an employment standpoint.
Do you do anything immigration-wise?
Do a little bit of immigration. We have a number of clients that
will
try
to
hire,
right now.
You know, employees with visas. And so we do a little bit of immigration work. That's really specialized and technical.
Yeah.
So I've got some resources that I'll get people with if they need something that's beyond our scope. But, you know, we're talking about an H-1B visa or something like that. You know, we can handle that. And It's just really providing the day-to-day advice and support for business owners, HR professionals, executives on how to respond to a variety of employment matters,
yeah.
how to comply with multi-state regulations, federal and state law across the country is varied. And we have a lot of companies that operate nationally and internationally. So you might be dealing with, you know, the legality of something in Oregon or whether Minnesota law applies to this situation. But I've been doing that for, I guess, almost 18 years now. I've been at Chambliss my entire career.
Did you know you wanted to do labor?
I don't think employment law
when you got there, or was it just a natural transition?
It was a natural transition. I mean, I really thought, as a lot of people
I just assume you'd be a litigator.
Well, I am.
Okay.
So I do employment litigation. I think that's the common misconception is that employment lawyers don't litigate. We litigate.
You try not to.
If we're doing, I would say if we're doing a good job, but if we're getting called on the front end, we can keep people out of court. But
right.
sometimes people are a little penny wise and pound foolish and don't seek the advice, but come to us for the cure. I thought when I went to law school, I wanted to be the quintessential litigator, you know, Denny Crane on Boston Legal or Harvey Specter on Suits, and fell into it kind of backwards in an internship at Chambliss. Just really liked the area. It was a great blend of kind of the transactional advisory approach and litigation. And so I took to it like a duck to water and have been doing it ever since.
Let me ask you this, and I'm always curious about this. You're dealing with business owners.
Yeah.
Business owners, by and large, are fairly headstrong.
Mm-hmm.
But now I'm dealing in an area where I may own something and I may be pretty smart at what I do. But when I get into that legal world, I don't know.
Well, to your point, I've got a good friend of mine who just took a CFO position. And he was calling me about healthcare benefits. And he was like asking me some questions about it because I've kind of sat in his seat before. And I was telling him, I said, one of the first things you need to do is you need to go have lunch with my buddy Justin at Chambliss. You're going to need an employment lawyer at some point. He's in the construction development world. And I said, it's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when.
And I'll tell you what, I would rather develop that relationship on the front end previous to running into the problem.
Absolutely. Nowhere to go.
Because I may be able to call Justin and say, all right, I'm looking at XYZ, and here's
how do I not get sued?
What are the potential pitfalls?
Absolutely,
because if you do that on the front end,
yeah.
I may avoid a head-on crash.
Yeah, that's right. We're all the time doing that risk analysis, and I mean, the unfortunate part of what I do is I can't quantify how many lawsuits I've prevented over the years, although it's probably thousands. But we never know if you don't call me on the front end. I can fix a problem on the back end, but fixing the problem is a whole lot more expensive than preventing it on the front end.
Well, it's not dissimilar to our business in that the earlier you get out in front of issues or problems, if you start thinking about retirement at 40 instead of 60, it's going to be easier for us to help you.
That's right.
Same concept. If you get out in front of issues or you're having questions about whatever it might be.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great point, and the way I typically handle things with clients is, you know, to a large degree, I can get them to the result they want to get to, but we might have to take a few steps to get there to make sure it's appropriately documented, we've got the policies and procedure, whatever the case may be, but as long as I can be brought in that early stage and understand what your goal is for the backing, we can probably get there and prevent that.
Well, the other thing that happens is, in essence, I know as a business owner where I want to go.
Mm-hmm.
You're telling me on the front end what are the issues with what my goal and objective happens to be. You got to be able to look out for 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5.
Mm-hmm.
That's right. And I mean, sometimes, as you alluded to, people don't take our advice. And all we ever hope is that they go into their decisions eyes wide open, right? I can tell you what the legal landscape is. I can tell you what your risk is with option A, B, or C. I can tell you what I would do,
right?
But as you mentioned, business owners are often headstrong. I had one client tell me one time, I'm going to ask you a question. I know what you're going to tell me, but I haven't made as much money as I've made in my life listening to lawyers. And he was right. He asked me the question. I told him what he thought, and he ignored it.
Why did he even call you?
I think just for fun.
Okay. Just curiosity.
Yeah,
sometimes. I didn't know if he was trying to check a box. Like, yeah.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, people just like having conversations with me. And so
he just wanted to talk at him for a little while.
Yeah.
He's just getting bored. That makes sense. What?
Hey, the thing I know about you, you all have that in common. Let me tell you this about that.
Go
walk into those Chambliss offices and I'm meeting with Justin or somebody like that, one thing I do know, we might be friends, but the damn meter's running. So come in ready to have a conversation. I mean,
yeah, be prepared.
You got to kind of have your stuff together.
You're not saying it's not worth it, but you're saying don't come in unprepared.
But I mean,
and you prefer that too, right?
Look, in the accounting profession and the legal profession, both, what you are, we're selling with time.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's the unfortunate thing about being a lawyer, right? I mean, we do sell time.
One of the many.
I do think that people temper their use of legal services because of their fear of the billable hour. And I always like to tell people, hey, look, like, I can probably give you a good answer in about 12 minutes if you'll let me. Now, we can go dot the I's and cross the T's and spend a little more money, but I try to take a really practical approach, understanding that not everybody wants a $10,000 memorandum that's 99.9% right. You know what I mean? They may want good gut check over a 10-minute phone call.
Absolutely. Yes.
Well, and you'll pay a little bit for that, but I don't want to end up fearful of having the conversation.
No.
That's right.
Because the conversation may keep me from a pitfall that is going to be significantly more expensive down the line.
And that's what, you know, as someone also that used to sell my time, I was in the same boat. I always told clients, like, don't hesitate to call me. I'm not just turning the meter on as soon as I pick up the phone, but I need you to tell me what's going on so I can help you take care of your problems.
Well, you know, and I've always, the fascination that I've always had with the industry you came from, Kyle, is that people tell me all the time, I don't just want somebody to fill in a box. I want somebody that's a real planner.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think real planners cost more.
Yeah.
That's right.
Real planning takes more time and energy. Because now I'm asking not simply to check a box, but I'm asking for your expertise for how and why this thing ought to be formed a certain way.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and you may think you know what the potential pitfalls are, but I may be able to point out things, corners that you didn't see around. I mean, I had a client call this morning that wanted a quick gut check, and after 10 minutes he goes, you know, I thought this was going to be a simple question, but you're telling me it's far more nuanced than I ever imagined. And I said, yeah, we're going to have to look into it. If you want to do it right, and you are legitimately, and this was an in-house lawyer, you're legitimately worried about the outcome or, you know, whatever's going on, then, yeah, we do need to do it right to put some time in.
And that's a business decision. It's not a legal decision always. It's always a calculation of, is it worth X, Y, and Z weighed against the risk of what could happen?
That's right. And I think lawyers get a bad rap because there are many lawyers that will provide you the legal advice but shy away from the practical business advice.
And, totally agree with that.
And frankly, I think that's what I try to do is, yeah, I can tell you what the regulation says or what the case says
or whatever the contract says.
But you could maybe Google that if you knew what you were looking for. So you really need to take my almost 20 years of experience and put that into play for you to say, okay, I've seen this before. I know how this plays out.
I'm looking for the nuance.
That's right.
Right.
I'm looking for the subtleties of what it is that I do not know as the business owner about an application of ABC.
That's right.
And where you're saying, okay, here's the obvious one and two that you got, but here's 3, 4, 5, and 6 that we have to deal with about 25 or 30% of the time.
Yeah.
And 25 to 30% is a pretty big number.
That's right.
There's a likelihood. If I got a one-third likelihood of ended up in a bad legal scenario because of a decision that I made that was nothing more than an unforced error because I refused to have the conversation with justice.
Stupid.
It makes no sense.
Stupid.
That's right.
267-1023 is the number. It's Let's Talk Money. We'll be right back.
Let's Talk Money. Talk Radio 102.3.
You're back with Let's Talk Money. 267-1023 is the number. Got Justin Furrow with us today from Chambliss. Justin, you're supposed to, from your marketing team, you're supposed to make a plug, and let's not forget to do that. So tell us about your conference coming up.
Yeah, it's our annual labor and employment seminar. We've done it as long as I've been at the firm with a brief interruption during COVID. It's March 4th, which is 2 weeks from today. Morning and afternoon sessions at the firm. We will have a variety of our lawyers speaking on, you know, not really hot topics, but what's shaping the workplace today. So you'll hear about litigation trends, the HR implications of AI, kind of the presidential administration, the impact that's having on employment law. And then I'm going to do a more nuts and bolts kind of documentation investigation, kind of how you do that as a executive, business owner, HR professional. So we've got information on our website. I can, if anybody wants to email me directly, I can send you the link. But we do have those two sessions. My understanding is we're about two-thirds of the way full already with two weeks to go. So If anybody's interested, please feel free to register. But it always proves to be, I think, and not just because I put it on, but really impactful for those that attend. It opens up areas of HR they maybe weren't focused on, or illuminates some things they've been having trouble with, and really offers a good networking opportunity for area executives and HR professionals to kind of meet their peers and talk about the problems that are vexing them on a day-to-day basis.
So it's more geared toward your HR executive level person that needs to understand kind of what's coming down the road.
Yeah, we have all kinds. We have in-house counsel that comes. We have, you know, the HR directors, VPs of HR, CHRO. We have business owners that come that maybe have, you know, a growing company but don't have a dedicated in-house HR department or a dedicated legal department. Just anybody that needs to understand kind of the employment world in today's climate.
Now, I'm assuming this is not necessarily your area of pure expertise, Justin, but what are the legal implications coming down the road that you hear talked about relative to artificial intelligence?
Oh, man. So I think in my area of expertise, right, is utilizing AI to screen applicants, to screen job candidates, and kind of how that works. I think that's going to be a big play over the next 3 to 5 years.
God, I haven't even thought about that.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really hot topic in what we do now. I think the main area it's going to hit us immediately is AI taking the place of jobs, right, taking people's jobs. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you have a number of companies that are working through that analysis of how much impact AI is going to have on which jobs and what they need to do from a workforce planning perspective. I think one of the major law firms, I want to say Baker McKenzie, just cut maybe 600 positions in the last couple of weeks because they're working on AI replacing some of those roles. And so just from kind of the reductions in force, terminations, workforce culling, whatever you want to call it, I think that's going to be the area of impact. And then I think it's really going to transform, you know, what the modern workplace looks like. There's all sorts of horror stories about it's going to completely end my job. I think I could probably finish out my career before the AI bots replace me. But it's really going to transform, you know, how people interact with coworkers, whether they're interacting with a physical coworker, an AI chat bot, what the number of workers used to produce the same output is, and then how we're screening those candidates and using ChatGPT or whatever to do so.
I think one of the articles I was reading, and it related to your profession, was
you
have people like yourself that are partners.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Used to be associates.
That's right.
And the associates would do research.
They would.
All of which can be done by artificial intelligence. Now, I guess the bulk of which can be done that way. And then I begin to wonder, or how the hell is the associate going to become the partner if they've never got to
That's
be an associate?
It's a great question. And I'll tell you, to put a finer point on it, yeah, AI can do the research. Where we are right now in the current LLMs is it's not there on legal research. It'll get you an answer that may or may not be right, but in terms of the source citations, I mean,
What's
seen
LLM?
It, all large language models. Sorry, that's what the AI people talk about in the biz. But you see all sorts of lawyers getting sanctioned in court for filing briefs that have case citations and quotations that are entirely made up. They're hallucinations. And so I would equate AI in the legal world right now to a good intern, maybe a first-year associate in terms of drafting things, in terms of getting you a research
that you can take to court or put in a legal document.
Yeah, you still need people for that. And, I mean, the corollary, you know, some of our elder lawyers remember the days where you had to do all the research in books, and then we had these new legal search engines that made that research so much quicker, and that was going to phase out the need for associates because we could just do the research with a click of a button instead of spending a week through the books. That was 25 years ago, mm-hmm. and we still have associates doing research. So I think the best way that I heard it or I saw it on LinkedIn was if you're a lawyer, AI won't take your job, but the lawyer that knows how to effectively use AI will.
That's what we talk about a lot here. And I think Jim and I have talked a lot about AI, the quote-unquote threat that it has on our profession. But frankly, I think if you lean into it and understand it as a tool, it can be exponential growth, can provide exponential growth to the opportunities that you have. You know, you think about the third-party software we use called Orion, that it's a data aggregator.
Yeah.
We can press a couple buttons and tell you what your return is since you've been a client, no matter how long you've been here, pulls the data in, spits out a report in seconds, that would take hours for us to calculate by hand.
Number one, it's made us incredibly more efficient.
Yeah.
And number two, it's made us more accurate.
And how long ago did you implement that software? 2000s, early 2000s?
Probably 2008, 2009.
Yeah. And so that product has gotten better and more efficient, but it hasn't replaced anyone here.
Now, I'll tell you what it has done.
Made it where you didn't have to hire anyone.
Yeah, yes. It's affected the amount of people that would – the volume of clients we had would require three or four more employees or five more employees than we presently have.
Yeah.
To provide the same level of service that we're providing at this point. So we're getting a greater level of service, and we're able to do it with fewer employees. But there does come a point when your business increases, you are going to have to hire people, but not at the rate you used to.
Right.
Yeah, and I think the key word that you guys said is efficient, right?
Yeah.
It makes us as lawyers more efficient, which is beneficial to our client because we can do something quicker. We bill by the hour. If we can do it in 1 hour instead of five, that's a cost savings to the client, and it gets them the product quicker so they can keep moving at the pace of business.
Well, and I'm constantly hearing the articles that say, oh, that's right now, at the stages I see it in, it's an enhancement of XYZ.
Well,
it's not to the destruction of it.
And now, to your point, if you got 20% more efficient, it's not like you'd be bored. You would go fill that with more work.
Yeah, that's right. And it's
valuable work that you want to do.
It's creating an interesting tension in the legal world. I mean, 15 years ago, alternative fee arrangements were all the rage. And
yeah.
They never quite took on.
Accounting was similar.
Yeah, they never quite took on and got broadly adopted because at least with what I do, I don't know when employment issues are going to arise, and I don't know how litigation is going to go. The idea of monetizing the AI product or the AI-enhanced product is going to be something that, frankly, the legal industry as a whole struggles with, and I think it's going to require the input of our clients. I mean, I was talking to a client one day who was really saying, yeah, I understand that you could do a five-hour project in 1 hour, and that's a cost savings to me, but it's just as valuable to me as the five-hour project because I get it so much quicker.
Yeah.
So I would pay for that value the same amount as I would pay on the hourly rate.
Yeah.
We're going to have to figure that out as an industry.
Well, I think that's a common one across the board for any hourly billable person. You're going to have to move more toward a value bill, and we talked about that a lot.
Look, guys, I'm also going to assume if it's $18.85, I'm a blacksmith, and I'm reading an article about some new invention called the automobile that's going to come along
right.
and destroy me. Now, 40 years later, I can look at it and go, yep, they destroyed me, but I made a lot of money during that damn 40 years.
Yeah.
I mean, are any of us thinking that how we do business today is how the financial advisor or the attorney is going to be business 40 years from now? No, it's
hopefully
going to be
not.
Different.
Well, and I mean,
it's always been different.
So just in my career, which, as I said, is 18 years, you know, we started out in suits and ties.
Yeah. Now you wear tennis shoes.
Now we wear tennis shoes.
Love it.
We started out, you know, in-person meetings all the time, conference calls all the time. Now my clients that are in Oregon or Nebraska or Minnesota, we're on Teams calls.
Yeah.
You know, I can do mediations. I don't think they're as effective all the time, but I can do mediations over the computer. We have Zoom court hearings. You know, you got to make sure you take your cat filter off, but you can have a court hearing over Zoom. So that's transformed the way that we practice. And I have a friend whose father's in the personal injury world, does insurance defense. They love team and Zoom hearings because now they don't have to travel. A lot of insurance companies won't pay for the travel.
Yeah.
So they can do, you know, more. 10 hearings in a day. They make more money because they can sit in their office and do it.
Now, what is required is that somebody be competent.
Yes.
That's right.
You
know how to use the tools.
Yeah, the tools are the tools. I get that and I understand that. But the individual that's running it and the individual making the decisions, the individual preparing the case has got to be competent.
That's right.
And they have to check the AI output, right? You can't just blindly rely on it. You have to double check the sources and make sure. And what I found is they don't always say what they said they say. I think we have a number of situations where I've plugged a research question in. I think the answer's right, but when I go for the backup, give me the case that says this, the case says nothing about what I asked.
Yeah, it's interesting. 267-1023 is the number. Let's Talk Money. We'll be right back.
Let's Talk Money. Talk Radio 102.3.
You're back with Let's Talk Money. 267-1023 is the number. We've got Justin Furrow from Chambliss, Bonner & Stoffel with us today. All right, Justin, employment law question. Explain the difference in an exempt and a non-exempt employee, briefly.
Briefly, okay, got it.
Nuts and bolts,
so
practical.
Very briefly, an exempt employee is not entitled to overtime pay if they work more than 40 hours in a week. A okay. non-exempt employee is entitled to be paid 1.5 times their regular rate of pay if they work overtime. Now, common misconception.
Yes.
Salaried employees does not make them exempt, right? So simply paying someone a salary, and this is what everyone thinks.
Yeah.
Well, they're salaried. They don't get overtime. And I always like to say, you know, I took French in high school at Soddy Daisy, and I learned what au contraire, mon frère, means.
He's a real cultured guy.
I'm a clearly. Renaissance man. But simply paying somebody a salary does not make them exempt. Now, it's true the exempt test requires them to be paid on a salary basis. But there is also various job duty tests that you have to look at, whether it's a learned professional, an executive, an administrative, and that doesn't mean administrative assistants. But it is far more involved than just saying, I pay a salary, therefore I don't have to pay overtime.
And I think this is one that I don't think it's intentionally missed, but I think a lot of employers and employees miss this. So, like, there could be people out there that are salaried but are, and correct me, they're exempt. They do have to be paid overtime?
They're non-exempt.
Non-exempt.
They're being treated as exempt.
Correct.
So they're not getting overtime, but realistically,
they should be.
They should be. And it is a... For the business owners that are listening, it is a very hot area of potential liability because of the availability of class actions. They're actually called collective actions.
Well, I mean, the truth is you have business owners out there that say, I could pay this person hourly. I could pay him $50,000 a year.
Yeah.
If I pay him hourly, I'm going to end up paying him $65. I can pay him $50 and work him 10 hours and I don't get caught.
Right.
And, you know, frankly, most of the time the employees don't care. They're happy to be paid a salary.
No, they're trading
guarantees.
A for B, yeah.
Well, and in their mind, and I've heard this a number of times, employees want to be treated as a white-collar employee and be paid a salary. They don't want to be a blue-collar, just an hourly employee that has to track their time. Now, for me, I would love to be paid on an hourly basis. I would love to get overtime, right? You won't insult me by paying me on an hourly basis. But you're right. Most business owners don't understand. Most employees are happy with it until the bad thing happens and they lose their job or whatever, and then suddenly they go talk to a plaintiff's lawyer, they realize there's a potential class action lawsuit there, and it becomes, you know, whereas you might have paid $10,000 to that employee in overtime over the course of their employment, you know, but you've got 50 people, 20 of which are in the same boat, then you have a 20-person class action, and those numbers stack up pretty quickly.
Oh, I got a deal here.
Let's hear
I'm going to pay Justin hourly.
Okay.
$12 an hour.
Perfect. He'll take it.
100 hours a week.
Okay.
Might take 13.
Well, you got to pay him 18 for anything over 40, right?
Yeah, it'd be 18 for anything. Look at that math.
I mean, you know, it is interesting that when you talk about somebody going, I mean, I talk to people that come in here and they're working hourly, and I had a surgical nurse that's really high end, long term. Yeah. She makes $52 an hour. Will you multiply $52 an hour and you go 45, 50 hours a week, all of a sudden that person's making $130,000 a year.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, a lot of the medical profession are on the hourly rate. It's not something that you should be ashamed of. It's just the nature of the job that you do.
Is the nature of putting people on salary when it's an hourly type of job, is there a lot of that, Justin?
I would say there's a fair amount of it. It's never... or at least in my experience, it's typically not an intentional way to avoid obligations that you know you have.
It's just
you hear salaried means you don't get overtime, and so you just pay somebody a salary, and it works out well for everyone.
And everybody's okay with it.
Everybody's okay until they're not.
What causes people to realize that they should be getting overtime? Like, what's the general kind of...
Typically,
kicker?
People are clued into that when they get terminated.
Okay.
Typically, they've seen something on the internet, you know, plaintiff's lawyers advertise their results in these collective action lawsuits, and so they'll see something like that. Maybe somebody has a similar job, and they just recovered, you know, in their mind, $1 billion, you know, and so they start getting frustrated with they haven't gotten a pay raise, or they're pulling their fair share of the weight and somebody else is not, and so they hit the Google machine or they go to AI, and they realize there's a potential thread to unravel there.
Do you ever see people go negotiate, you know, I hadn't been getting paid overtime. If you give me this raise, I'll just continue on. Or, like, is that a comp? Like, do employees hold that over employers' heads, I guess?
I don't know necessarily that they have the negotiation that way. And what I would tell the client if they called me is, you know, you can't really waive away your rights that way. You
right.
still have some potential liability out there. But I think, you know, what ends up happening is you get, and I think this comes up a lot in what we do, you get a new HR professional that's doing an audit, or maybe it's the first HR professional that you've hired, and they're looking at the business, and then they call us and they say, hey, we really think these people are misclassified.
Mm-hmm.
How do we fix it? Because
yeah.
you got to have a really deft touch there in remedying the problem, but not walking yourself into a big lawsuit.
Well, and I think there's also times, and you may be talking about this, where you could go, the job description that you have documented may not actually match what the person is doing. And you need to be careful to make sure your non-exempt employees have that appropriate, you know, they're managing people, they're doing the certain things where what they're doing needs to be appropriately described. Does that make sense?
Yeah, because your first evidence of what somebody does is the written job description. But we see all too often, as you said, the job they do every day does not match the words on paper. And what courts look to is not the words on paper, but it's what functionally does this. I realize we described it well and we checked
yeah.
all the exempt boxes, but what are they really doing?
Yeah. Well, I just remember I had a customer at the old firm that had some people in management positions that weren't, their job description didn't actually say that, but they were emphatically doing the job that they did not, they shouldn't have been getting overtime. And
yeah.
so it wasn't that they were being underpaid, it was just that they qualified. And so we had to go back and redocument it. And
yeah.
this is part of it. You just got to be aware. Those are the things that can get you and catch up with you.
Let me ask you this, Justin. There's a small percentage of time I'm going to assume here where you've been hired to do XYZ.
Mm-hmm.
You look into XYZ, and the guy that hired you is dead wrong.
Yeah.
Now, I know you have criminal defense attorneys that defend people that, in their heart of hearts, they may go home that night and go, this guy's guilty and I'll get out. Is it ever your job to tell the person you're working for that you need to do this differently?
Yeah, I mean, I do think that's my role, right?
I'm looking for that kind of advice to say, I would be constantly asking the question, am I out of line here or am I out of touch with what's going on in today's world?
Yeah, I mean, that's what I deal with every day is somebody saying, hey, employee A wants X. What's the legal requirement? We've been doing it this way. Is that okay? And if not, what's our risk? And I think, you know, the interesting thing about our client base, I rarely, if ever, run into a client that I feel like is intentionally doing something wrong and has gotten caught on it. Do people do stuff wrong every day unintentionally and it results
sure.
in a lawsuit or, you know, an administrative charge or whatever? Sure, but we don't have the
it's
type
not
of,
J.R. Ewing just trying to screw somebody.
That's right. And
yeah.
and I'd say we're fortunate enough to not have the type of client base.
Well, that's what I was going to ask.
Yeah.
What do you do when you do have a client that's like, hey, I know this is wrong, but I want you to do it anyway?
You know,
we ran into that all, not all the time, but occasionally in the tax world, it's like, hey, I know this is cheating on my taxes, but I want you to do it. And I'm like, I'm not doing that.
Yeah.
No thanks.
So I can answer that a couple of ways. One,
it's not as black and white.
There to advise you of the law and the risk. And whatever decision you make, as
yeah.
long as you go to it eyes wide open, that's yours. If I feel like somebody's intentionally trying to violate the law to the detriment of their employees, they're probably going to be a former client.
Yeah, 100%.
Now, the difference is you're giving me advice. On the other hand, Kyle, you're putting your name on my
exactly.
return.
That's exactly.
Right.
That's the nuance difference.
They're asking you to cheat here.
Yes.
You're telling people what the repercussions are, Justin.
Yeah.
You're signing off.
Yeah, I'm always like, oh, so you want
me
to risk my career, my license that I worked really hard for so you can save a few $1,000 in taxes?
No, thanks.
Yeah, and the same goes with litigation for us. I mean, I have to be sure everything
yeah.
you're saying is 100% true because I'm signing that pleading just like you're signing a tax return.
Yeah. 267-1023 is the number. Let's Talk Money. We'll be right back.
Let's Talk Money. Talk Radio 102.3.
Listen to Let's Talk Money, 267-1023.
I got a question for you, Justin. How do you, in the legal profession, you're dealing with all types of business owners out there. How do you make yourself come across real? yet knowledgeable. Where there's you've got to blend personality. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're one of the few accountants I've ever met that actually had a damn personality. I give you credit for that.
I appreciate it.
And I don't mean that as a slam against my friends that are really good accountants that don't have a great personality.
Yeah.
But figuring out where that line is.
Yeah, I don't think you can make yourself seem real. I think you are or you're not.
I agree.
And for me, it's kind of what you see is what you get. I've never taken myself too seriously. I know what I know. I'll tell you what I don't know. I'm not going to put on any sort of airs or affronts to interact with you. I think you're coming to me because you've maybe heard something or read something about me. You know my expertise, and I think we're going to get along pretty well because I'm just a down-to-earth.
Well, my struggle with you is really simple. How can you be a polished attorney from Soddy Daisy? I mean,
it's a great.
Hey! Wait a minute!
Sorry about that, Max.
Well, you know.
I'm kidding, by the way. I don't want to get bad news.
Well, people. I think Kyle was struggling with the descriptor polished.
That's where I was curious. What, you know, I know Justin pretty well, and I wouldn't say polished in the first three descriptors.
It just depends on what venue
where
you see
is.
Him.
That's right. I'd like to go watch him.
I mean, if it's a tequila venue, probably not so polished.
Well, I don't want to argue with him either. I bet he's a great.
No, you don't want to get. I don't want to get in a debate with him. I certainly don't want to get a debate with him in his office because he's charging me money. I really don't want
that fancy barista bar that they've got up there. It's
you know, there's only one quasi client that successfully beats me in arguments every time and always refuses to take my advice, and we share a last name. And, so she's the only one that doesn't appreciate my perspective on
No, that. She is not the only one that does not appreciate expertise, I can promise you.
Are you mostly litigating or mediating in those?
I'm mostly just holding on for dear life.
That's awesome, man.
We wouldn't be talking about your bride, would we?
Yes. But I do have a 13-year-old son, 11-year-old daughter, so I'm the least
you're
important.
The least smartest in the room.
Exactly.
Yeah, important. Your opinion carries the least amount of weight.
That's
I'm
right.
learning that.
That's right.
It's a cruel world, but whoever said never a prophet in your own land?
Yeah, that's right.
Is what it is.
Love it. Justin, thanks for coming today, man.
Thanks
I think this
me.
Was great fun. How do we get a hold of you if we've got questions or somebody wants to reach out about the conference?
Yeah, so reminder, conference is March 4th, 2 weeks from today, morning and afternoon sessions. You can find me on the internet, chambliss.com with two S's. 756-3000 is our direct dial. Just ask for me. Be happy to talk with any of our listeners today, and would love to see them show up at our conference.
Love it. Thanks for being here again. Coming up next, Yaffe Live 1 to 3, Sport Talk 3 to 7. We will talk to y'all tomorrow.